You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia. According to the influential linguist Noam Chomsky, we're all born with a basic grasp of grammar. He argues there's a universal structure at the root of all language and that it's hardwired into our brains. Now, Mark Hauser, a provocative professor of psychology at Harvard, has taken this idea one step further. In his new book, Moral Minds, he writes that we're also born with a universal moral grammar, an instinctive sense of right and wrong. Mark Hauser, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, you've described your idea of this innate moral faculty as a universal toolkit, a system that generates moral judgment. How does this idea of yours compare with current views on the subject?
So I would say the way in which our view is different from how other people have talked about it is, in prior thinking on moral psychology, there have really been two different views. On the one hand, have been people who've thought that the way we come to a moral judgment is through a very careful, rational, conscious process of reasoning from explicit principles. The alternative view is one where the process is really intuitive, but it owes its inspiration to our emotions. So we decide what's right or wrong by appealing to our emotions. That may be unconscious or it may be conscious, but emotions are doing all the work. Our view is closer to the intuitive emotional view, but rather than appealing to emotions, we argue in favor of a view that there is really a kind of a cold moral calculus that appeals to an assessment of what an individual believes, what they intend, what their goals are, and the consequences of their action. What I've often referred to as a universal moral grammar, a set of unconscious principles that drives our judgments.
But isn't a key part of your hypothesis that it's innate rather than learned?
The argument that I want to make for morality is there are a core set of principles that all human minds share that set up a range of possible moral systems to acquire, not specific ones. They were born with a capacity to acquire multiple systems, but there are significant constraints on those. So, for example, most people that we've studied using a web-based experiment called the Moral Sense Test suggest that in different cultures, people of different ages, educational backgrounds, religious backgrounds, men, women, perceive actions that cause harm as morally worse than omissions that cause harm. Now, that's something that parents aren't sitting around telling their children, look, when you see an action that leads to harm, you should think of that as morally worse. It's something that's derived by the child seemingly universally.
But isn't this the very question that's being debated right now and that you haven't proven?
Yeah, I mean, the proposal that's, for example, in my book, Moral Minds, is really a proposal for how to think about the problem, and it's not a knockdown argument. So by analogy, if you look at the book that Steven Pinker wrote called The Language Instinct in the 90s, that was an argument for how to think about language, but based on decades of research in linguistics. The argument that I make in Moral Minds, which is very much equivalent to the kind of argument that Chomsky and then Pinker, in a more popular sense, made, is one about a way to look for evidence that would either be consistent or inconsistent with what we've said. So one of the ways in which we begin to gain confidence that there may be something innate, something that is biologically shared across the species, are sort of two pieces of evidence. One is, when we can find evidence that across quite a lot of cultural variation, people make the same kinds of judgments, that suggests that at some level, that cultural variation is not impacting the system that's driving the judgment. It seems to be immune in some sense. The second type of situation which gives evidence for it being innate is when we ask people, okay, you said this case is morally forbidden, but this case is morally permissible. Please give us an explanation. When they can't deliver the explanation, that seems to be unconscious. If they don't know what the explanation is, they certainly can't teach it. And that, again, would be consistent with the idea that it's part of the mind's hardware that's basically bringing forward this judgment.
Let me ask you for an example of one.
Okay. So, for example, taking the classic kind of cases that have been used before, these trolley problems, which are very familiar to most people, capture a crucial ingredient. So the classic case, the trolley is coming down the track. If it continues, it will kill 5 people. A person is standing next to the tracks. If that person flips the switch, the trolley goes onto a sidetrack where it will kill 1. Is that permissible? Using thousands and thousands of subjects on the moral sense test, we find that most people say, yes, it is permissible. Now, a very similar case. Here comes the trolley again. It's going to kill five people. You are standing next to a person with a heavy backpack on, 200 pounds. And if you shove them, that person lands on the track. They get run over by the trolley, but the trolley stops before the five. The five are saved. Is that permissible? Most people say no. Now, most people respond yes or no very quickly. There's not this deliberation. It comes by very, very quickly. And for many people, there's no clear explanation for why they went one way or the other. And the reason why these cases are of interest is because if you are a strict utilitarian, only paying attention to consequences, both cases are five versus one. If you were a non-consequentialist, meaning you only pay attention to rules, like killing is wrong, that wouldn't work either, because in both cases, your actions lead to the death of one. So what you find are cases where there's a tension between rules and consequences, and people struggle with these. But what's interesting to us is they deliberate very quickly. They come to a conclusion quickly, intuitively, and often without access to any kind of principle.
But the question really is, you argue that people can't really figure out why they feel differently about these two things. But isn't it rather simple? We don't like having intimate relationship with murder or death. We don't like to knife people. We're much happier to shoot them from a distance. This is an instinctive preservation of our sense of our own morality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is that for any given, let's say, isolated moral problem or even a pairing of them, it's often easy to come up with accounts that will satisfy what's going on in those cases. What we consistently find is that when you begin to pile up a series of moral problems, people begin to lose why they say some things for one case and another. So let me give an example. Doctors in a hospital, five people in critical care. The nurse says, each person needs an organ to survive. We don't have time to send out for organs. But this healthy man walked in off the street. We can take his organs and save the five. Is it okay?
But here's a situation again where to cut open a healthy man and take out his organs is a very intimate, hands-on act, just like pushing somebody to stop the train.
Right.
So really, this is a somewhat obvious distinction, I would think, between how close we are personally involved with the act, whether, you know, technology distances us quite conveniently from our own feelings of guilt.
So what if you were standing next to a switch which launched the guy next to you onto the track? Is that okay? Now, most people say that the flipping him onto the track is way worse than redirecting the train. Now, the account that explains these differences are people seem to be averse to using a person as the means to the greater good. Whereas in the redirecting the train case, you are foreseeing the consequences, but that person is not the means to the greater good. For example, let's say on the sidetrack there was nobody. Now it's not merely permissible, it's actually obligatory for you to flip a switch, right? If there is no man with a backpack, you have no means. You have nothing to throw. There's nothing you can do. So he actually becomes the means to the greater good. Now that does a lot of work. It doesn't solve these problems. It simply does some work which most people are not aware of. So I think the general point that we're making here, and I think we've only skimmed the surface, is philosophers who have worked with these problems, people like Francis Kamm, a colleague of mine at Harvard, has this very intricate view of the psychological distinctions that begin to play a role in changing people's intuitions. That's a kind of way of thinking about the grammar of action. That is the kind of work that Chomsky has done with linguistics. I think the linguists are light years ahead of where anybody in moral psychology is today, because people haven't thought about this problem. They've simply assumed in most cases that if we have an intuition that we can't explain for why this is right and that's wrong, it's because of emotions, and emotions are doing the work. And I think what we're trying to challenge is that's not the only story.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm speaking with Mark Hauser, a professor of psychology at Harvard College. What does the term morality mean to you, Mark, and how do you differentiate it from moral norms or basic social conformity?
So I've always been averse to definitions because ultimately in the area that I traffic scientifically, you know, I do something with animals and I find something and people say, oh, and therefore these animals have language. But the term language and morality are so broad and encompassing that if you define it, in some cases you define it away. And in some cases, what's clear is that these complicated systems like language and morality are built from different kinds of components. So let's just take morality. Before I define it, let's think of what goes into it. You perceive an event and you say, that's forbidden. You've made a judgment about an action not being okay. Or somebody does something and you call that person virtuous. They've done something very nice, altruistic, generous. So in each case, there's been a perception, there's been some digestion, and there's been a diagnosis. Okay, now what enters into that is a lot of complicated things. And let's just take an extremely simple example, which I think will help because it will bring us back to some of the work we're trying to do on animals. If I throw a rock at someone and it hits them, there are two interpretations. I intended to hurt them, or I accidentally let go of this rock and it hurt them.
And you're able to study in animals that they're aware of this distinction.
That's right. So we've got some evidence that animals make minimally a distinction between a kind of intended versus accidental distinction. Now, if animals don't make that distinction, they simply pay attention to the consequences. That suggests that the means just don't matter. And they're already, by definition, kind of out of the moral domain. Because kids, of course, go through a stage where consequences matter most. That's what they think about in terms of punishment. And then the means become very salient.
In terms of kids, you write about the fact that at the age of 4, they really start to develop a moral faculty. How are you able, as a scientist, to separate out that development from the influences of culture, of society, of parents?
I mean, what we're trying to do is, and this is actually it's the same exact move as we're trying to do with adults, which is that when we do our work with adults, we don't ask people, so what's your intuition about abortion? I mean, there's no intuition about abortion. Either you know you think it's right or you think it's wrong. So what we do is we try to create dilemmas that are very unfamiliar, but that capture some of the crucial psychological distinctions. And that's equally true for kids. So the basic idea is if we can move cross-culturally and create dilemmas that nobody has familiarity with, but that nonetheless generate the same kinds of distinctions, that's going to suggest that whatever culture is doing, it's not impacting these differences. Now, we are not at this point really investigating the psychology, the neuroscience of moral behavior, but rather of moral judgment. And what people do, I think to me at this point, is a complete mystery, in part because there's so many complicated things that take place when you do things. So here's something that's familiar to most people who live in cities. You walk by a person who's homeless, they ask you for money, and on day one you say, sure, here's a buck. And on day two you don't. Are you now evil? No, you're not evil. There's lots of things that can interfere with why you did it on day one and not on day two. And that's a complicated story, which I don't think science is prepared to answer yet.
Again, your idea is that we inherit a sense of sort of this basic building block from which morality can grow.
Correct.
Meaning that what one thinks about feeding the homeless is almost irrelevant to this initial source of moral structure.
That's right. That's right. And so ours is the first intuitive cut. And then, you know, what we and moral philosophers and legal scholars hope people then do is they take that intuition and they reflect on it. Because not all intuitions are going to be the thing that we ought to do. So the crucial distinction here, one that's been rehearsed many, many times in the history of philosophical thought, is the distinction between a description of how moral judgments occur versus a prescription of what we ought to do.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. Mark, if this universal moral faculty is hereditary, as you say, then it was selected as an advantageous trait. But couldn't the opposite argument be made, that evolution favors people who are tough and selfish and try to win at all costs?
So I think the question, which is a good question, really puts into the foreground the difference between the judgment and the behavior. So on the one hand, you could argue that selection is operated on the psychology leading to certain patterns of judgment, but selection is also operated on what we do. So people often ask, look, how can there be anything universal when you see the horrors between Israel and Palestine? That can't be universal because look at all the atrocities. If they knew that killing was wrong, they wouldn't do what they're doing. That confuses the judgment part with the behavior part.
Last question, Mark Hauser. What are you working on now that might help bring light to some of these issues?
I think there are three things that I'm kind of most excited about that we're working hard on. One is what the analogy with language invites is this notion of a moral organ. Are there dedicated circuits in the brain that are specifically involved in moral judgments as opposed to other kinds of social problems? So here we look to patients who have damage to certain parts of the brain to see whether those circuits, when down, have differential impact on people's judgments. Developmental disorders like autism, where people afflicted with this really horrible, kind of devastating disorder, don't recognize others having beliefs that are different from our own. How does that impact on their moral judgments? So that's one class of studies. A second is to really try to enrich what we can learn about cross-cultural variation as well as universality. And here we're working closely with anthropologists, working in small-scale hunter-gatherer societies, where we try to convert these dilemmas into cases that they can understand, of course, in their own language, to see whether we find a common signature where it's very different cultures, very different from the traditional Western cultures that we're familiar with. The third links kind of development and evolution. How early can we see signatures of these universal distinctions between action and omission? Do infants show them? Do animals show them? And the crucial idea here is, if we can show that animals and babies who are not yet moral agents make distinctions like action and omission, then it suggests that those psychological distinctions are not specifically moral, but they get recruited into our moral judgments.
Mark Hauser, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, just for fun, I've saved Mark's title for last. Are you ready? He's the professor of psychology, organismic and evolutionary biology, and biological anthropology, an adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Education, as well as at the program in neurosciences, co-director of the Mind, Brain, and Behavior program, a fellow at the Center for Ethics, and finally, the director of the Cognitive Evolution Lab. And all of the above is at Harvard. That's it. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for listening.